Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
You're listening to Achtung Norwalk, broadcasting from the beautiful South Berlin. Accept no substitute.
Good morning, dear listeners. Welcome to Achtung Norwalk. This is the third in my series of Christmas shows, looking at Millwall items of historical and cultural significance, as I'm choosing to call them. Today we're looking at, I'm actually looking at the Lions of the South book, the famous masterwork by James Murray, which it occurs to me as I'm speaking is in itself an item of Millwall cultural significance, a beautiful book outlining the history of the club from 1885 to the mid-80s, written by Millwall writer James Murray. It is a fantastic piece of literature and history. But included within it, which is the specific thing that I wanted to look at this morning with you, is a famous page, and it's a reproduction of a page from a magazine in 1910 called Lottinger's Weekly. Lottinger's Weekly was a sports magazine, effectively. I'm just looking at an internet website as I'm talking. Lottinger's Weekly was an illustrated journal of sport. It started in March 1910, so this page is October 1910, and it was killed off during the war when horse racing restrictions were imposed. It was kind of like a horse racing and football based magazine. Its tipster was known as Larry Lynx. I like that, Larry Lynx. And he moved on to another magazine called John Bull, which was a patriotic magazine during the First World War, managed by a guy called Horatio Bottomley, who was a well-known MP, magazine owner, and eventually did some time for financial swindle. But we're straying from the point of today's item, which is a page relating to the opening of the new den. Not our new den, Coalblow Lane as the new den in 1910. So this magazine is dated October 29th. It's headed Millwall's New Ground, and it's got a series of photographs taken at Coalblow Lane on the occasion of the grand opening against Brighton in October 1910. The little piece of description here, it says, after many years' sojourn at East Ferry Road and North Greenwich, the old Lions of the South, Millwall, migrated to a more populous district of New Cross. The opening ceremony of the new ground was performed on Saturday, where the Southern League champions Brighton and the Hove Albion provided the successful opposition in a one-goal match. The Brighton beat Millwall famously on the opening of the den at Coalblow. And they got a series of photographs taken at the opening, which was opened by Lord Kinnaird, who was the chairman of the FA. Some of the captions at the bottom are slightly hard to read, but you can certainly see Lord Kinnaird with his white beard there. I think Lord Kinnaird had played in the first FA Cup final. He was certainly a major figure in FA Cup history, in FA history. There's a very amusing anecdote that such were crowds at the new Coalblow Lane ground, that Lord Kinnaird had gone to the wrong end to get in to actually open the ground officially. He'd gone to what we now call the Alderton Road end. In the history Lions of the South, it's billed as the Canterbury Road End, Dog Track End, whichever way you want to call it, where Lord Kinnaird, Old Etonian, Lord High Commissioner, merchant banker, wealthy landowner and big cheese in the FA had gone to the wrong end. Such were the crowds at the opening of the new stadium that he couldn't get round to the correct end, which would be the Coldblow Lane end. And he had to be dragged unceremoniously, says James, in over the gates to get in to make it down to the Players' Tunnel end, where he's pictured in Lottinger's Weekly performing the honours to actually open the ground. So, as I say, the photographs are, it's a reproduction of an old magazine, so they're a little bit hard to make out, but I can see there's an image of the Coldblow Lane end, the crowds above the Players' Tunnel, at the old Coldblow Lane end. Two faces in the crowd ringed, and they are entitled to match tickets on the account of Lottinger's Weekly, for if they can identify themselves. Below that is Lord Kinnaird handing the ball to the opposition captain. And another image of Carmichael, the Millwall goalkeeper, Carmichael. They didn't do first names much in those old times. Number four is Lord Kinnaird declaring the ground open. They're shaking hands with the Millwall captain in his dark blue shirt alongside the Brighton captain in his blue and white stripes, which still prevail to this day. Other images, Elijah Moore, the Millwall groundsman, famous figure in Millwall history, Elijah Moore. He was actually the one of the secret team that had actually come over to New Cross to weigh up various sites. The reason that the club moved from the island is also detailed quite nicely by James in the Lions of the South book. It describes it as a deserted island, falling crowds in a nutshell, on the Isle of Dogs. The club had obviously drew its origins from the docks and on the island, but it was always a difficult place to get to, so there was a somewhat limited pool of supporters over there. So other clubs such as West Ham, such as Woolwich Arsenal, and other clubs in London were drawing bigger crowds, and Millwall Athletic were finding that the limitations of that curious bend in the river that creates the Isle of Dogs meant that population-wise, and the difficulties of travel to get to the end of the island, it's a bit of a mission, even today, I suppose. Maybe with the DLR it's speeded up, but back then it was not an easy journey to make. And consequently, crowds were proportionally lower for Millwall Athletic. So despite us being the Lions of the South and, you know, a very successful side in those times, there was an increasing desire to tap into a bigger population, which was found to be at the Surrey Docks and New Cross. And that's where a team was dispatched from the club to travel over and size up the various sites. They looked at a few sites. One was at the back of the Rose pub in New Cross Gate. The actual site of Coldblow Lane was a kind of like a market garden, and that was the site that was eventually chosen. In typical Millwall style, there were various missed deadlines to open up the new ground, and consequently a series of last ever games on the island. The official last game was actually played against Portsmouth. The ground had actually been due to open for the start of the 1910-11 season, but for various reasons, Coldblow Lane wasn't ready, which led to the official last game eventually being put back to October the 8th, with the final game to be played on the Isle of Dogs, a 3-1 victory over Portsmouth, a carnival occasion. James Murray describes it here as Frost putting through Vincent to score in the opening minute, whilst Martin notched up the others, leaving Portsmouth's Turner the honour of scoring the last ever league goal north of the Thames. So that was the last league game played at North Greenwich. The programme notes, which James quotes here, refers to the den. Everything will be in order for the opening game when the Southern League champions Brighton and Hove pay us a visit a fortnight hence. It was little thought that such a delay would occur when it was announced during the closed season that the ground would be ready for the opening match of the season. However, as I have before explained, the delay has been quite unavoidable, and whilst many supporters have met with disappointment, the club management have equally suffered, and in no small degree financially. That sounds very familiar, doesn't it? So delays and management copping it in the ear and reminding people that they have also been under the cosh themselves. But in typical Millwall style, that wasn't quite all at East Ferry Road. So that was the last league game, a 3-1 win over Portsmouth on October the 8th. 2 days later at North Greenwich, there was positively, as James puts it here, the last game, a London Professional Challenge Cup tie, and the visitors were none other than, and quite fittingly, as James puts it, Woolwich Arsenal, one of Millwall's oldest foes. An eyewitness wrote that the tie between Woolwich and Millwall in the second round of the London Challenge Cup did not produce much good football. The victory at the home side, so Millwall won it by 1-0. So a scuffly game to finish. That sounds very, very familiar to me, dear listeners. There's a really nice few paragraphs that James Murray has written about the kind of severing of the links with the Isle of Dogs, which I'm going to, if you'll indulge me, just going to read them back to you. So this is obviously dated October 1910, but it describes the a kind of imagery of leaving the Isle of Dogs. So James says, when the final whistle blew, the Millwall players waved to the cheering crowd and said their goodbyes. Millwall were leaving the island, while the island, in turn, had lost a friend, an industry, a recreation, and a vital part of its lifeblood. No longer would the Saturday afternoon crowd pop into Uncle Tom's cabin in British Street for a packet of Woodbines and a cup of tea on the way to the match. Or if they fancied some of the harder stuff, Bass and Worthington Best Bitter at the Lord Nelson, still the closest pub to the ground. Or maybe Taylor Walker's at the Manchester Arms on Cubitt Town. Some for luck would stop at Horace Jeffries' pub, the London Tavern on Manchester Road, for a pint of Lion Brewery's mild or stout. Nor would they visit Elijah Moore's Toilet Club in East Ferry Road for a shave before finding the proprietor overseeing things a couple of hours later at North Greenwich. As bad as the ground was, its very ugliness helped build a legend. It was well known that even if the uncompromising Mill defenders and the mighty Tiny Joyce didn't put off the opposing attackers, then the young supporters sitting behind the goal throwing handfuls of sand into their faces would. No longer would the new hero Bert Lipsham be seen hobbling off the field with a displaced cartilage and take 5 minutes to work it back into position under the noses of cheering fans. No longer would Millwall be the only club to play in an inland city, yet have the piercing toot-tooting of ships cutting their way through the misty river just yards from the ground, drowning the cheers of Millwall's own supporters. And no longer would those supporters stand together behind the arch's end, facing 120 yards further on, the fans at the Cubitt Town end, together urging on their boys in blue, the old Lions of the South, through the clinging mud. When the last bike was collected from Peter George's football ground's cycle score next to the station, all that was left was an empty pitch, a bumpy pitch, deserted terraces and memories. Thousands and thousands of memories. But the fact remained, Millwall Football Club had outgrown the island. That's really nice. I don't like to read large sections of text. I try to do these a little bit more ad lib. But that was just beautiful. And I just wanted to read it because I really admire that as a piece of writing that somehow captures the essence that led to our first item on today's show. A page from Lottinger's Weekly, headlined Mill's New Ground, when the den, Coldblow Lane, was the bright spanking new home of Millwall Football Club.
Achtung, Millwall.
So there we are, dear listeners. It would be the den in Coldblow Lane, New Cross, where Millwall would truly forge its name and its reputation, shall we call it. The Island of Dogs being... The Isle of Dogs, not the Island of Dogs. The Isle of Dogs being left behind in 1910. Which takes us on to our second item of Millwall historical and cultural significance. I've chosen a photograph of that was sent to me, in actual fact. A photograph of the Evening Standard, the London Evening Standard. And it's dated November the 10th, 1967. Headline, banner headline, front page of the Evening Standard. We only make front pages, listeners, when there's something bad that's gone down. And this was one of the big incidents of the 1960s. Another bombshell at the den. Refs told to boycott Millwall is the banner headline in this Evening Standard, dated Friday, November the 10th, 1967. This piece is by Harold Palmer. More chaos in the soccer world today, he says, exclamation mark. The latest bombshell came from the referees. The Football League Referees and Linesmen Association have advised their members not to officiate at Millwall until the club has completed arrangements to keep spectators off the pitch. This means there may be no referee to take charge of Millwall's home game with Portsmouth at New Cross tomorrow, especially as the Referees Association, the national body, have promised support. No blacklegging. Blacklegging is the old term for breaking of a strike. The Referees Association must be like a trade union of some sort. The member Cyril Jackson expressed the opinion there'll be no blacklegging and no one would take control of the game, and the advice will be that will be the advice given to their members, he says. This followed infamous incident that took place against in a 2-1 loss against Aston Villa, played a month earlier in October, in which the referee, Norman Burtonshaw, was allegedly attacked. Choose your words carefully, Nick. He was injured as he left the field following a late disallowing of a Millwall equaliser in a game against Aston Villa. Late equaliser, disallowed by Burtonshaw. A lot of kids swarmed onto the field, youths, and in the scuffle, let's put it that way, in the scuffle, Burtonshaw was injured. That's probably the best way I'm going to put it, actually. I think that's probably less accusatory, isn't it, dear listeners? Got to be careful how you put these things. So I'm just looking at the Daily Mirror 1 month earlier from that other edition, the Evening Standard. This is about a month earlier, October the 16th, Daily Mirror. Front page of the Daily Mirror. Oh, God. We only make the front pages following riot and mayhem, dear listeners, don't we? And anyway, we've made the front page banner headlines on the Daily Mirror. KO'd ref, knocked out. Club faces FA ban. Soccer chief warns we may close the ground. Millwall, the club in a football storm over mob violence to a referee, is expected to have its ground closed down. The referee, Norman Burtonshaw, was knocked out after Millwall lost 2-1 to Aston Villa on Saturday. Hundreds of fans, mostly teenagers, swarmed onto the pitch at Millwall's ground, the Den in East London, South East London. Then, in angry scenes that followed, Burtonshaw, 41, was battered to the ground. It's very, very florid prose here, isn't it? The FA were considering action, which would include closure. I mean, obviously, the Den has been closed 4 times over history, most recently in 1978, which I do remember. I remember going to a home game played at Portsmouth in the late 70s. But this we actually avoided closure following this incident. The report continues. This is Dennis Follows, the FA secretary. I cannot tell you what happened. Oh, this is Burtonshaw's report. Apologies. This is Burtonshaw's report to the FA. He said to the press, I cannot tell you what happened. Everything will be put in my report to the FA. Trouble flared after Mr. Burtonshaw disallowed a late goal in the closing stages of the game. He had to be rescued by policemen who carried him to the dressing room for first aid treatment. And there's a few other articles in the Daily Mirror showing a knocked out Norman Burtonshaw being attended to by St. John's ambulance men. Unfortunately, most of the scans don't really do justice to the photographs, so you can't really see the full gory reality of it, but it certainly looks a bit at sixes and sevens. Club chairman, Mr. Mickey Purser, club chairman, said, quoted to the press, we are very concerned about what happened, but beyond saying that I cannot comment until the referee has made his report, there are just too many conflicting stories. The one thing I'm certain of is that it would be no use closing down the ground for a while. This is a nationwide problem and not one that just involves Millwall. He continued that we had ample police at the match. Referee's wife, Mrs. Dorothy Burtonshaw of Great Yarmouth, said Norman was shaken. I don't know why I'm putting this voice on. They said, I'm going to put that voice on. Norman was shaken when he got home. He said that the crowd came on the pitch and he was knocked down. That's Dorothy's quote. And there we are, front page of the Daily Mirror, alongside an image of Elizabeth Taylor dressed up in semi-royal looking gear at the opening of her new film, Dr. Faustus. But that's unrelated to Millwall matters in any way, shape or form. The club would actually avoid closure, as I've said. I don't know how we avoided closure, but we did. We got a £1,000 fine, and I think we were required to put up fences around the side of the den, which were there when I first started going. It wasn't a terribly big fence, and I think many of the great and the good saw the club as paying lip service to the idea of fences at the den, but it was like a very small, if it was 12 inches, like a yellow rail along the top of the wall, really. It served no purpose in keeping anybody off of the pitch, that much is for certain. But there we are, all sorts of other articles. I'm just looking through the search here. Millwall's ground must be closed, says the People, Sunday People. Ken Jones advocating closure. Millwall Club has a problem. And so it continues. The Illustrated London News. We even made the Illustrated London News, dear listeners, like a society magazine. In fact, that's got a good photograph. I might borrow that with a contorted Norman Burtonshaw being carried from the field. This is a long series of examples of hooliganism. There was a rising time of hooliganism in the game. Hooliganism and rioting, not just at Millwall. I mean, this is across the game generally. Maybe my light tone is doing it a disservice. I don't know, but it occurs to me as I'm speaking. There's been fighting both on and off the pitch and rowdyism, both at matches on the way to and from the ground. That's the Illustrated London News. So we've certainly made it to the big time there, dear listeners. So there we are. The Evening Stand, I'm going to borrow that Illustrated London News image as well. And my final choice, the final item that we're looking at is the plaque that we arranged with Lewisham Council to erect on the site of the old den on Colblow Lane. This was back in 2010. Well, that would be one of the anniversaries of 135 years. Since the foundation of the club, but I felt it was for a long while that there was nothing to mark the site of Colblow Lane, the ground, with the move to Zampa Road in 1993. The old den was demolished, as I'm sure you know, listeners. And sadly for me, it was rebuilt by Fairview Homes, but sadly, in my opinion, the names of the roads reflected the fact that the den had been there for many, many years. No players' names, nothing at all. And I felt this was wrong. And consequently, I, alongside some members of the Lions Trust, when I was involved with that at the time, we applied to Lewisham Council to mark it in some way. They have a system of like maroon plaques, which they agreed to put up, and so the image of the plaque was instigated by the Lions Trust. I filled out the form, long form actually, asking why this place was important and why it should be marked, and I filled out a Lewisham Council form, remember doing that quite clearly, and emailing it in on behalf of all Millwall supporters. And in 2010. They put the plaque up. It was put on like a brick stanchion. I don't know what you'd call it, really. A brick kind of column as you enter John Williams Close. John Williams is not, I think that's a Fairview choice of name. John Williams is not related to being Millwall at all. Many, many names you could have chosen that were Millwall related, but not John Williams. And we had a little ceremony. There's a picture of our fan on the board at the time, Pete Garston, alongside the mayor, Steve Bullock, boo. He'd later become a villain of the piece in 2017 when Lewisham wanted to repossess our car park and develop it. But at this stage, he was still Lions Trust member number one and a person who I think he saw some electoral value in throwing his lot in with Millwall. And there he is opening up the plaque in 2010. So there we are. That's my own personal link to the plaque. I don't know if it's still there. I think it wasn't high enough, in my opinion. It had to be put down quite low. I think we struggled to get permission to put it on the side of people's houses where it would be up and up higher and you couldn't get to it. So it was fairly low, and consequently it remains prone to vandalism. I think it was nicked a while ago. I don't know. I haven't been round there for a long time, listeners, so I don't know if it's still there. But certainly it was there for some time, and it was the best that we could do to mark the site of the den. So it's a maroon plaque with the roaring lion and the old Pattercake Lions badge, London Borough of Lewisham. On this site stood the den, the legendary home of Millwall Football Club from 1910 to 1993. I haven't looked around there for a long time. I hope it's still there. I think it was nicked and they were going to replace it. Whether they did replace it or not, I don't know. But there we are, the Millwall plaque. That's the third in our list of items of Millwall culturally and historically significant items. Lotting us weekly to start us off at the Den. We have Norman Burtonshaw's infamous incident in 1967 to give a flavour of one angle of Millwall history that you can't avoid, whether you like it or not. And then finally the plaque to close the door at the Den story, erected in 2010. I hope you're enjoying these little shows, dear listeners. Do let me know what you think, whether you are or you are not. We're going to carry on with these up to Christmas, in the hope that they help to just sweeten up the current semi-lockdownish, not quite, zone that we're in. So there we are. I'll sign out at that point. Thank you for listening, dear listeners. I do appreciate it. Do let me know any comments that you have. achtungmillwall@gmail.com is our email. We're on Twitter, obviously, at achtungmillwall. Do leave us a voicemail if you want, 0208 144 0232. And if you're still interested in getting a Millwall, Achtung Millwall commemorative calendar for 2022, we've still got a few available. I'd like to get shot of them all, if I can, and generate a good donation for the Lions Food Hub. But we still do have a few left, so go onto the MSC shop website, Mill Supporters Club shop, and place your order. Not many left now, so I'm hoping to shift them all one way or the other over the weeks ahead. Thank you for listening, dear listeners. Until the next edition, thank you for listening, and arrivederci, Millwall. Bye for now.
This is the staff announcement. Mr. Den has left the stadium.
Hooray! Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.